dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, a man we've turned to with regularity for his insights into a number of the battle spaces in that war is Matt Brodsky. He is one of the go-to guys, as far as I'm concerned, on matters involving the Middle East in particular, an area that he has followed closely in a number of different capacities over the years. We're catching up with him at a moment when things seem to be hotting up a bit with respect specifically to Iran. Matt Brodsky, it's good to have you with us. I guess one can at least take note of, it's not exactly celebratory, but take note of the fact that 40 years ago this week, the Iranian mullahocracy was established there and has been doing huge damage to the region and other parts of the world ever since. But tell us a little bit about what the Iranians are up to at the moment as it relates specifically to Israel, and even to the point, as I understand it, of threatening American forces they want removed altogether from Syria.
Well, Iran is continuing to embark on its entrenchment program to its west, specifically Iraq and Syria is where a lot of its concentration is right now, but also Yemen as well. We saw in recent days Israeli strikes using apparently their tanks in the Quneitra area, which is right along the Golan Heights, the frontier between Israel and Syria. That's more unique than the airstrikes, which we see a lot more frequently, and also is another indicator that Iran is continuing to set up bases and staging grounds as close to Israel as it can get inside of Syria. So this is the type of projects that Iran is continuing on, and it's whether they decide to make it look so abrupt and in your face at times, or whether they kind of try to keep it, below the radar, so to speak, a little bit. But it goes on nonetheless.
Yeah. And the strikes that the Israelis have been making have been reputedly pretty lethal for the Iranians. Are you surprised that there hasn't been more of a kinetic in-kind response from Iran? Or is that consistent, again, with this idea of just sort of laying the groundwork for a more and more concerted capacity to do violence to Israel in the future?
I think there are a couple of reasons Iran has not escalated even more so. Number one is that it can't afford to go to a war, either monetarily or literally. It just knows that it would lose in its current position if it were to launch something and it got out of hand with Israel. But another factor that Iran has to consider is that it's essentially remaining in Syria to a large degree by the good graces of Putin and Russia. And from Russia's perspective, it needs stability in order to start realizing the financial gains it could reap from reconstruction. So if Iran were to just start creating a huge mess inside of Syria, that would really bother Russia, who may say things or act against Iran behind the curtains while, of course, publicly chastising Israel, because that's kind of how they've been playing the game recently.
Yeah. As you see this increased pressure on the United States to remove its forces, the president, of course, is anxious to do that. He's made no secret of his intent to declare victory and move out of Syria, at least in terms of our ground presence there. Matt, I've been tracking, as I assume you have somewhat, at least the fact that as the caliphate has been physically largely destroyed in the areas that the Islamic State operated in Syria and Iraq, it seems as though it's opening up a new caliphate operation, not in the Middle East, but in Nigeria. And I'm wondering what the implications might be of that if we declare victory over this outfit prematurely, and it turns out they wind up getting their hands on, well, among other things, a lot of real estate, including a lot of oil and natural gas.
Right. So this is a major point. Number one is that ISIS, we're just playing whack-a-mole with them. We have to crush their caliphate in the heart of the Middle East, and that's good. So they're shifting their resources elsewhere. And as long as there's a physical caliphate, that is a much bigger draw for Muslims around the world in general, just the adherence to a physical caliphate. Another important factor is that the reason that ISIS pretty much chose Raqqa in along the Euphrates River in Syria as their de facto capital is because it's in a very wealthy, resource-rich area, but specifically the oil that was nearby, which was a major way it could finance its work. It is going to find that kind of home in Nigeria as well.
Yeah, this is really problematic in so many respects. They were bad enough when they were relatively small and impecunious. I can only imagine what we will face if, as you say, their appeal to like-minded Sharia supremacists around the world is fueled by not only a new and vastly larger physical caliphate, but also vastly greater wealth. Lastly, very quickly, Matt Brodsky, I wanted to ask you about this attack on a busload of Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps personnel in Iran itself, not too far from the Pakistani border. Who would you assume might be responsible for that rather bold assault on the IRGC in its own homeland?
Well, clearly there's no shortage of Sunni groups that would love to claim responsibility, and many have, from Al-Qaeda to ISIS splinter groups. I think one of the important factors here is that given the nature of the target, the bus of that many IRGC members, and it being reported on Iranian state media, last I heard was some 27 or so IRGC members killed. If it's on state media reported that way, that means there's likely even more. One might assume that there was another intelligence agency that was helping or that had information on that, just given the nature of the high value target that was brought. So an interesting development.
It is an interesting development, and I guess it's presumably a taste of what we might expect to see more of in an Iran that is not only now clearly regarded by its myriad opponents as ripe for a fall, but also evidently experiencing continuing ferment at home, especially as its economic circumstances plummet. It's so good to talk with you, Matt Brodsky. It's always a pleasure. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon, because all of these issues are clearly going to continue to unfold in ways that will have profound implications, not just for the regions involved, but also for us as well. Keep up the good work, my friend. Thank you for your time today. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Stephen Young on the lessons of our diplomatic defeat in Vietnam for one that may be in the offing with Afghanistan. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Stephen Young, who these days is the Global Executive Director at the CO Roundtable, which is an international network of business leaders who have helped fashion and are promoting the practice of principled global capitalism. And that is a subject for a very long conversation that I hope to have with Stephen Young soon. He's written a book on the subject, Moral Capitalism. It seems to me extraordinarily timely at a moment when there seems to be a considerable enthusiasm, inexplicably, for socialism as an alternative to greedy capitalism. So we're going to have a visit with Stephen Young on that subject soon. But For the moment, we're going to focus in on the subject of a very important essay that he recently posted at Small Wars Journal that caught my eye. It was about how we really lost Vietnam, and why this is so topical and so important are the lessons that we should learn from the secret negotiations that Henry Kissinger conducted with the North Vietnamese that wound up materially contributing to our defeat in that country seem to be lessons unlearned as we proceed with a new set of negotiations with an enemy that is every bit as determined, I think, as the North Vietnamese were to see our defeat, namely the Taliban in Afghanistan. Stephen Young, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us about these important topics. And I know we won't do justice to them today, but we'll begin and we'll have you back soon for a further conversation. But welcome for today.
Thanks, Frank. Glad to be on your show.
So just quickly reprise for us the character of the negotiations that Henry Kissinger engaged in to the exclusion of our South Vietnamese allies. As you've been a student of this for a long time, but you were on the ground in Vietnam as a participant in a very important program called CORDS. Tell us a little bit about that and the perspective that it gave you on what Kissinger was up to.
Right. Basically, Frank, CORDS was I would argue, the most successful counterinsurgency program our country has ever conducted. And we this is the key point, working closely with the South Vietnamese and South Vietnamese villagers, defeated the Viet Cong and Hanoi inside South Vietnam. And because we lost the war in Vietnam, we turned our backs on this technique, this success, and never used it in Iraq and Afghanistan. So here we are in Afghanistan, 18 years later, the president says, I think 19 years, and we don't have victory in sight. And so now we're negotiating with the Taliban behind the backs, really, of our allies.
Which is what we did in Vietnam.
Which is what Henry Kissinger did in Vietnam. And if you know, your audience may remember sort of the big dynamic. Kissinger comes to office under Nixon in early 69. He's been trying to be a mediator between the U.S. and Ho Chi Minh and Hanoi for other people, for Johnson and I think Nelson Rockefeller. Anyway, now he's in the White House. He's National Security Advisor. And the political parties involved were superficially four. Okay, so there was Washington, D.C. There was Hanoi, the communist regime in Hanoi. And then there was the NLF front and the South Vietnamese government.
The NLF front, I guess, would be better known as the Viet Cong?
The Viet Cong, which they claimed to have their own independent government, which we knew at the time. We knew in retrospect it was all a front set up. In fact, now documents have come out. The anti-war movement has never apologized for their mistakes. We now have documents in public from Hanoi in 1960, which are the instructions from Hanoi to set up the Viet Cong inside South Vietnam. Anyway, so after the Tet Offensive, which your audience may remember, Johnson abdicates from the presidency, really, wants to start negotiations, and there's a big fight over who the parties are. The compromise is it's four parties, and we swallow sitting down at the table with the Viet Cong. Kissinger comes in and basically says, in terms of raw power, there are only two parties. There's the U.S. and there's Hanoi. And this shows that Kissinger really was very condescending towards our allies.
Yeah, contemptuous, I would say.
Yeah, contemptuous. One could say more. So his strategy, which he then sort of sells to Nixon, is that we will come up with terms on how we will extricate our American forces, and then implicitly we'll just leave the South Vietnamese, you know, hanging. And that later on, there were a couple of people who call that theory of Kissinger the decent interval.
Is it not the case, Steve Young, that he kind of engaged in a bit of a bait and switch with Nixon on this? He was professing that this would be, you know, peace with honor and all of that. In fact, he was selling out our allies and cutting and running, which is unfortunately his hallmark.
So in order to figure out, because I came across his duplicity and his sellout by accident. Years ago, I was helping an older man, Ellsworth Bunker, who'd been our ambassador in Saigon, write some memoirs. And I got to go through all of Ellsberg's records and his secret cables with Kissinger.
You said Ellsberg. Did you mean Ellsworth?
Yeah, Ellsworth. Yeah, I worked with him personally for a summer back in 79. And I went back to him. I said, Mr. Ambassador, it looks like ABC that when you told President Thieu that Henry Kissinger was committed to withdrawing the North Vietnamese forces, as a matter of fact, he didn't actually say that to you. He dissembled. And we now know, and I've talked to some other people, that this was in May of 71. The other important thing, Frank, is the sellout occurred very early. Not at the end in 1972, but very early.
It was kind of structural, though, wasn't it? Because they were engaged in the cutout of our allies, and everything else just sort of flowed from that.
That's right. And so, well, I got to know Nixon because I wanted, because Kissinger had implied in his memoirs that all this was really Nixon. You know, Nixon did all this stuff. So I got to know Nixon, which took time. He's a very suspicious man. And I became his friend in the 80s when he was ignored and everything. And then finally I had a meeting where I asked him, I said, you know, Mr. President, did Henry ever tell you about this and what would happen? And he looked surprised, even a little bit shocked.
Shocked as in shocked or shocked as in he was genuinely hearing something he didn't know?
He didn't know because he said, no, I don't remember any of this. Then he said, Steve, what difference would it have made? Oh, because the background again, Frank, sorry, is Henry Kissinger asked Ellsworth Bunker to come up with a peace plan. Bunker came up with a peace plan. There's a plank in there that said Hanoi's troops have to leave just as the American forces have to leave. Kissinger took that out, right? Nixon didn't know about this. Kissinger never told Nixon. He'd taken out, you know, he changed Ellsworth's plans. So I tell Nixon, I say, Mr. President, this is what happened. And that's why we lost in the long run. And you never got peace with honor. And his face went gray.
Well, I have the feeling this wasn't the first time that he felt betrayed by Henry Kissinger, though, do you think?
There is evidence. I mean, yes, there's evidence from Haldeman and Haig and other people. But I mean, this now gets into the psychology of Richard Nixon.
Which is a subject for another day's conversation with you, Stephen Younger. We're going to run out of time, but I just want to try quickly to translate the insights from this particular episode in American history, a very dark chapter, I think it's fair to say, from, you know, four decades ago to today, when it seems as though under Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, we have a similar kind of negotiation getting underway with, as I said, a very determined enemy, the Taliban, that again involves the cutting out of our putative allies on the ground in Kabul, the government of Afghanistan that we've spent so much treasure and countless lives trying to support.
The lesson is don't cut out your allies. One, it's a fundamental immorality to cut them out because of all the sacrifices they have made. It's their country, it's their future. And what you just said, Frank, the treasure and blood that Americans have shed in order to help them. If you cut your allies out with a determined ideological opponent and you let them win the game in the long run, you have basically turned against your country. And my lesson is just don't do it. Now, that makes your negotiations tough. But, you know, that's what they pay you the big money for.
That's right. But this would seem to be, you know, diplomacy 101, Steve Young. And you've again, had firsthand experience with it on the ground in Vietnam and as a student of what went down. But just to capture the present moment, we have clearly signaled again to today's enemy, the Taliban, that we're prepared to go behind the backs of our allies. We've now got them, I think, talk about contempt, populating their delegation in these negotiations with the five Taliban commanders who were in Guantanamo Bay. This couldn't be more transparently a sign of their low regard for us and the certitude that no good can come of this kind of negotiation, doesn't it?
Exactly. This plays to the psychology that the Taliban have used right from the beginning. which is we will win in the end.
No matter what.
No matter what. So you will die today. You will be a martyr. It may take us 20 years, but God is on our side. And so now you can imagine what they're telling the people in rural Afghanistan, saying, hey, see, the United States is sitting down with our people. What we told you 19 years ago is going to be true. We're on God's side. God is on our side. You better work with us.
Well, and unfortunately, it's not just, of course, in rural Afghanistan where they have a lot of support, but they're increasingly they're back in the cities, aren't they?
Actually, to me, that's a bigger marker of our failure, because for years they were not in the cities. Why are they able to recruit so many suicide bombers and things like this now? Where have we failed in working with the Afghans to mobilize the people?
Yeah, and this is, of course, as you say, operating at a psychological level, but it's also, you know, at a cosmic level, the whole Sharia program that is ultimately going to deliver the world, not just Afghanistan, to their hands. This is a fascinating topic for, again, a much longer conversation. Stephen Young, thank you so much for your time today, sir. We'll talk with you again soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Jessica Vaughn. She is the Director of Policy Studies for an organization that I consider to be simply indispensable, particularly at the present moment when we are trying to make head and tails of what the president is determined to do about our border insecurity and the impediments that are being put in his way by, sadly, not just Democrats in the United States Congress, but seemingly quite a number of open borders Republicans as well. Her name is Jessica Vaughn. She is one of our go-to resources on these matters, as she is for many in the media, and of course, for those who want the truth up on Capitol Hill. She is a wonderful guest and always welcome here. It's been too long since she's been with us, but thank you, Jessica, for taking a few minutes on what I know is a busy day.
It's my pleasure, Frank. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, thank you. It's a busy day, I'm sure, for you and for all of us trying to track this stuff, because as we speak, which is before the Congress actually acts, but it is expected to shortly, on this so-called deal, you have actually troubled yourself to read at least the Department of Homeland Security portion of the bill and looking for information and hard facts about what the deal will do with respect to border issues and immigration more generally. Give us your reading of this piece of legislation.
Well, this legislation is what happens when Republicans appoint people to conference committees who aren't experts in the subject matter, and the Democrats appoint people to the conference committees who are and who have staff who are experts at extracting things to gum up the immigration system. It does obtain some funding for border security, but it contains an equal, if not larger, number of provisions that are going to exacerbate the crisis that we have at the border now with, I mean, it's a little bit of security funding, like a down payment on the wall, that's real, but there are other provisions that are going to make matters worse. For example, it provides more money to resettling people who show up at the border illegally and ask for asylum, that claim a fear of return. And these are mostly families, mostly from Central America, but really from all over the world, including countries associated with terrorism. It says that DHS needs to spend money basically resettling them. And gives more money to do that.
Now, that would be taxpayer money that would be spent on resettling these people. And, of course, resettling is only one of the things that flow from being allowed to stay in the United States, is it not, in terms of welfare programs and education and the like?
Exactly. It funds the federal government agencies that do the resettling, but then it's state and local taxpayers who have to pick up the tab for everything else, like schooling, welfare services, et cetera. So it's you know, it guarantees that we're going to keep having this problem at the southern border, because a wall doesn't stop people who want to be caught.
Right. Well, and more to the point, as you say, you're really watching the magnet for people coming here becoming more powerful, isn't it? Because it will be that much more certain that they will be able to make their way here, not only getting here, but of course, also inside the United States. Now, Jessica Vaughn, let me just ask you, because one of the things that we've been told about this this wall funding is, yes, that it's a first step to, you know, much more out year funding. I can't tell you how many times I've been told that bait and switch. But in this particular instance, there have been some comments about whether it actually is possible for that funding to be used to build 55 miles of new fencing or barriers, or whether it's intended to be, you know, to repair or replace some of the fences that are already there. Do you have any insights on that?
My understanding is that it is both, that it provides, it allows for the repair of the existing places, like, for example, in Southern California, where we saw the caravan basically busting through the obsolete barrier that's there, but also new construction all in the Rio Grande Valley, which is South Texas.
So that will be permitted?
Yes, that will be permitted. As far as I can see, I haven't read all of the fine print, but that's what the conferees are saying, that was the deal, that they would allow 55 miles of the steel bollard fencing like what is already there. Nothing new, no prototypes. Nothing that the president said he liked.
None of the improvements that he thinks are needed. And Jessica, when you candidly acknowledge that you haven't read all of the fine print, I dare say nobody in Washington has, with the possible exception of those Democratic staffers.
Right, and that's the problem. And this is one of those, like, we're told to pass it to find out what's in it. And that's why I think lawmakers should seriously consider what the Freedom Caucus has suggested, which is they've introduced a bill that would provide a week more of funding to avoid another partial shutdown.
A continuing resolution.
Yes, a CR to do that for a week to give people a chance to read the thing.
But specifically, one of the pieces that we've been told is in the fine print, and I don't know if you've seen it or not. I don't know if it's there, but it sounds right when you talk about the deviousness of the people who are determined to keep our borders open, who've had a very, very clear role on the Democratic side, specifically in these negotiations, but that they were essentially going to restrict the president's authority to get more wall built, either by moving funds around or using other authorities, by basically conferring on state and even local officials. It seemed like it was down to dog catchers. Anybody who interposed an objection to having a wall built in their area would be able to, if I can use the expression, trump the president of the United States. Could that possibly be in such a piece of legislation?
It could be. It wouldn't surprise me, because we knew that. I mean, this seemed like the obvious out for the Democrats to say, okay, we'll give you this money for your wall, even though we think it's immoral, and then make it nearly impossible for the president to use it. So we'll have to see if the Republican conferees were clever enough to forestall that. And there is apparently some way for the president to move money around and obtain additional funding. But again, we have to understand that the Democrats will use lawfare to try to at least delay it, you know, interminably.
Right. No, absolutely. And the question is, as you say, if you've had, as the Republican, you know, folks trying to provide correctives to what the Democrats have been doing on this, who aren't steeped in this stuff and aren't as skilled, I think it's fair to say, in trying to advance the agenda that the president has espoused since he was on the campaign trail to the present moment, we're likely to see a bad outcome here. And, you know, I just wanted to say, Jessica Vaughn, that some of why this is so important is, of course, the focus of a lot of the work that you all do at the Center for Immigration Studies. But it's so sharply in focus at the moment, I think, because of this conviction of the drug lord El Chapo in the past couple of days, and his conviction, among other things, for having brought something on the order of 200 tons of cocaine into the United States. Evidence, if any, were needed of the porousness of our border and the degree to which these drug lords and gangs and the like are able to operate with impunity across it.
That's exactly right. There were so many lessons we could learn, and that so much information that was revealed in this trial that should help us move forward with better policies. I'm not sure that policymakers are going to learn those lessons, but it was shocking to see how easily this criminal cartel moved this poison across our borders, and shows how insecure our borders really have been all of these years, all of the years that the Obama administration said, oh, it's more secure than ever before. And it really was not secure. There was no operational control. One of the ways that the drugs were moved across the border was simply in the cars of people claiming to be visitors going back and forth. And that shows you how little scrutiny we put on the border, and that there is this potential human cost to not enforcing our borders. It's not just about willing workers. The criminal cartels take full advantage of this, and it's also not just about the border itself. Stuff that makes it across the border illegally comes to every city and town across America.
Right. We're all border states, is how friends of mine are putting it. And Jessica, this is a really, I guess, thorny question at the moment, but I would appreciate your advice, as I'm sure would the president. Knowing what you know about the problem, and knowing what you do about at least the part of this legislation that you have been studying, would you recommend that the president sign this into law, take the money for the first little bit of wall, and see what he can do, despite other restrictions that may be in the legislation and what the lawfare types will inflict upon him? Or should he veto it and make them do it over?
You know, 24 hours ago, based on what the conferees said was in the bill, I would have said, go ahead and sign it. It's, you know, sort of a glass half full. After having read just one small part of the thing, I think there are some provisions in there that are so objectionable that the president needs to say, look, this, no, I'm not doing this. And with the cover of what the Freedom Caucus has introduced with a one-week CR, this stuff has to be cleaned up. For example, things like sanctuary for anyone who is in a household of an unaccompanied minor. I mean, really ridiculous enforcement stopping things that will cause public safety problems have to be fixed.
I would agree. And I think there's an awful lot to be said for the president insisting on these sorts of improvements, because they are certainly not going to be forthcoming otherwise. Jessica, thank you so much for taking some time to discuss these things today. I hope you come back to us in the week ahead or so when we have a better sense of what's playing out. Come back to us again soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by one of my favorite people, Michael Mabee, Command Sergeant Major, United States Army, retired. Very distinguished veteran of our nation's wars and man doing really important continuing service to our country with respect to the critical problem of our electric grid and preparing our American population against the eventuality that seems to be looming that we will lose power for protracted periods of time over large parts of this country. I'm very pleased to have him with us to talk a little bit about some of the work that he's doing to expose those vulnerabilities and try to get corrective action taken by those responsible. Mike, maybe it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back.
It's an honor to be here, Frank. Thanks for having me.
So I hardly know where to begin, Mike, but maybe with the recent bankruptcy of a very large utility known as Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E, out in California. You have been doing a lot of intrepid spadework, trying to find out what kinds of things have been done by PG&E that have put it in such an exposed position, you know, financially, but more to the point, have put the people it serves in harm's way big time.
Yes, and what we found, and this started about a year ago. This has been a year-long investigation. February 28th of 2018, the regulator for the electric grid, the North American Electric Liability Corporation, or NERC, filed a notice of penalty with the federal government, but they refused to disclose the name of the company. And in this was a host of cybersecurity violations that this company had been involved with. And NERC fined this unnamed company $2.7 million. So when we became aware of this, number one, it just does not seem right that the federal government would bless off on a regulatory action and the name of the company would not be named, because, you know, in America, disclosure is the cornerstone of our democracy. And when the federal government, you know, absolutely, I mean, on Wall Street, if the SEC files a lawsuit for securities fraud against somebody, they, you know, do a press release and disclose the name. If there's a recall of food, the Food and Drug Administration discloses the name of the companies involved. So this is, you know, how our regulatory system works, but not in the electric grid. So what we found through a Freedom of Information Act request is that the company that violated these cybersecurity standards was PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric. And, that ended up being quite a fight, because our FOIA request was initially denied and we had to file an appeal. But then during the course of this, at looking at this one penalty, we started looking back at the penalties that have been levied in the electric industry for cybersecurity violations going back to 2010. And what we found was that there were hundreds of instances where the names of the companies were withheld from the public. There have been 243 Federal Energy Regulatory Commission dockets. So this is the federal government, has 243 dockets where NERC, the regulator, withheld the name of the companies who violated cybersecurity and critical infrastructure protection standards. And they, you know, have covered up the names of these companies, and the federal government has blessed off on all of them.
Yeah, and Mike, there's so much here, and I think it just screams scandal. But and the stakes are so high, because, as you know so well, and I think our audience is pretty clued up about, without electricity, we're out of business. And I mean literally out of business, of course, but also as a country, we will not be in a going concern, shall we say, for very long. And you keep talking about this regulatory body, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. But in point of fact, this is a kind of hybrid beast, isn't it? It's as much really a sort of industry trade association as it is a regulator. And yet it's kind of a vehicle through which this very troubled industry is self-regulating, isn't it?
It is very, very troubling, and you know, the American people should be very troubled by this. The North American Electric Reliability Corporation is supposed to be the self-regulator for the electric utility industry. Now, interestingly, they are paid by the electric utility industry, by their regulated community.
Talk about regulatory capture.
Yes. So now, the way the law was written in 2005 that created this beast of a regulatory structure was that the public interest was supposed to be represented. Now, what's ended up happening is when NERC structured this and FERC, you know, the federal government bought off on it, essentially what it comes down to is that the consumers, the electric customers, and the government get three votes, and the electric industry gets 11 votes. So it's a completely stacked deck.
Now, there's also this other, Mike, just so we're clear with our audience, there's also this other layer of regulatory oversight, theoretically, something called the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, not to be confused with NERC. But it seems to be substantially a victim of this sort of regulatory capture phenomenon as well, is it not? And how does that play into what you've just shared with us in terms of sort of the cover-up of real misdeeds or malfeasance on the part of some of these electric utilities?
That's a great question. And what I have found is that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, since 2010, has been completely ineffective at protecting the electric grid from all hazards, whether we're talking electromagnetic pulse, cyber, geomagnetic disturbance, physical attack. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has not stepped up to the plate and protected the American electric grid. Now, part of the problem when you look at this, if you look at the last, so the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is a small government agency that's overseen by five commissioners that are appointed by the president. And over the last 15 years, the commissioners who've been appointed to run this agency have by and large come from the regulated industry. So they've come from the electric utility industry. They've come from law firms that represent the industry. And they've come from the, you know, kind of political energy environment. So all of these commissioners, they've all been cut from the same piece of cloth. Now, here's the other interesting thing about them is that almost all of these FERC commissioners, when they leave FERC, go back to the industry or to law firms representing the industry in high-paying, high-power jobs.
So they're not likely to be willing to cross or otherwise cause pain to these utilities that they're supposed to be regulating and overseeing on behalf of the American people, which again brings us back to your work, Mike. Maybe you have been burrowing into and exposing the kinds of cover-ups and self-dealing and other shenanigans of these folks at a moment when, if anything, the vulnerability of the grid in the various ways you've described, electromagnetic pulse, cyber, physical sabotage, geomagnetic disturbances, is greater than ever before, wouldn't you say?
Yes, correct. We're in a lot of danger, and literally nothing has been done to protect the grid from these standards. And the only thing standing between the American people and a disaster of catastrophic, you know, proportions, you know, a loss of the electric grid for any period of time, the only thing standing between us and that is FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is supposed to be standing up for the public interest in protecting the public. And they failed to do that.
Command Sergeant Major, United States Army, retired Michael Mabee, thank you so much for your time today. It's great to talk with you. I look forward to doing so further on all of these issues and appreciate your continuing service to our country. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.